No way.
Mr. Holly, I don't think I'm a potential customer, but just as a matter of curiosity, could you tell me in 1 minute what NADW sells?
Well, NADW sells a marketing program. They first sell a geographical area, and they sell a program that is being used very successfully in parts of the country, some unsuccessful in other
parts. Tell you how to sell cars, how to sell parts?
It has to do with warranties on used cars.
How to sell used cars?
Yes.
What does the N stand for?
National. Automobile Dealers Warranty Association. Thank you. Oh, may I ask the court one question? May I have leave the book to send the letter in a couple of weeks with these items?
You can send the letter in a week?
Yes, sir, in a week.
Oh. And you'll have an opportunity to reply. Perhaps it would help us to tell us whether you think Section 8 has nothing to do with military problems, but Section 8 is or is not a firm buyback agreement.
Your Honor, I think that the interpretation of Paragraph 8, if you interpret Paragraph 8 in a light most stringent against the party that wrote the contract, and that's NADW, that it could be a firm buyback agreement. They say it is not. They say that it is not a firm buyback agreement. Now, that question that Your Honor has asked gives rise to a possibility of, well, let's just suppose that we have the newspaper ad and it says firm buyback agreement, your investment completely secured, and there's no paragraph 8 in the contract. What would we have there? We would have a possible purchaser who was acting in reliance on the representation in the ad, asking the seller, where's the firm buyback agreement?
Well, you answered my question with a question. Is this a firm buyback agreement?
I don't think it is. I think that it could be construed as a firm buyback agreement by an individual with no experience necessary as they advertise for in their ad.
Well, they don't promise to buy back everything now, do they?
Yes, Your Honor, they do, because the Exhibit A attached to the contract, they assign the values to it. And it's all materials that are used. And they agreed to buy back NADW materials.
Is that total $14,500?
Your Honor, it totals, I believe, $23,500 for materials that are used, and about $1,000 for expertise and so on.
Why didn't he return for all of them and get his money?
Because they told him that, no, we're not going to give you your money back. What we're going to do is we're going to resell your territory. And then after we deduct everything from an expense of the sale of the territory, from the proceeds that we get from the sale, then we will give that to you. And his response, Your Honor, to that was, no, that's not what I bargained for. And his view is, once you've defrauded me, why should I trust you to perform again?
Mr. Dowling, you got a jury finding that there would be a firm buyback agreement.
That there was a firm buyback agreement.
No. When you check the wording, the jury found in response to an issue was that there would be a firm buyback agreement. Isn't that wording right?
I believe...
The wording is your special issue number one, if you will.
I believe... I believe that the wording was that there was a firm buyback agreement.
Is that, are you looking at the special issue itself in the transcript? Now, the point is, the Court of Civil Appeals interpreted that as being a promise to give a firm buyback agreement. Now, we've got a difference between a representation of an existing fact and a promise to do something in the future that the Court of Civil Appeals based their opinion on, and you're attacking the Court of Civil Appeals' opinion. And I'd like to hear someone address that point because I think it's critical to whether or not the Court of Civil Appeals heard.
Okay, Your Honor. That there
would be a firm buyback, is that a promise or is that a representation of existing fact?
Your Honor, it's a representation of an existing fact. And the reason is that the contracts were already made. All these contracts from Mr. Rodenheiser, who had been in there, and there's testimony from him, and he testified in the record that what it meant to me, that if I spent my $14,500, that if something happened and it didn't work, well, then I would get my money back. That they would buy back the materials that I purchased. So the jury had that.
Now, we're talking about what the jury found. Your jury finding.
Yes.
It was your burden to get a jury finding to support your cause of action.
That's correct.
Now, the issue you submitted to the trial court and the trial court submitted to the jury was that there would be a buyback agreement. Now, does that mean a promise? Does that mean representation of existing fact? Not what the parties thought, but the wording of the jury finding. Looks to me like we've got to go. What did the jury find, a promise or a representation?
It found that there was a representation to Donald P. Dowling that there would be a firm buyback agreement.
Not that there is one outstanding, but that there would be one. Is that a...
Was the NIDW newspaper advertisement representation to Donald P. Dowling that there would be a firm buyback agreement false? And they answered, it was. And that was at the... And that was, and that was at that time. That fraud goes to the point of time, and the intent, and so on, goes to that point of time in which it is committed. And they're stating here that representation in the newspaper that there would be a firm buyback agreement was false at the time, and they said it was.
Well,
now,
at what time? At the time Mr. Dowling answered the ad, at the time...
That's correct. The contracts, Your Honor, as I stated in my brief, were all boilerplate contracts. They'd already made up. They didn't have to put it in the newspaper if they knew that there wasn't going to be one, or that there wasn't one, or that they were not interpreting that was one. But they chose to put it in there to induce possible purchasers to rely on it. And as Mr. Dowling stated in testimony, and I believe that Mr. Holly failed to read this to you. He said that what this means to me is that any individuals availing themselves of this business opportunity has, as they advertise, a firm buyback agreement. And as they state immediately under that, it says, your investment is completely secure. Now, Chief
Justice... Did you submit an issue? I asked counsel for the other side.
I was just getting...
Your investment completely secure.
I was just getting ready to answer Your Honor with respect to that point, because the two go together. The concept of your investment completely secure is a corollary to firm buyback agreement. It puts the finishing touches on it and gives you the idea that what firm buyback agreement means is that your investment is completely secure.
Now, where did the jury find out about that?
Well, there was no issue on that submitted to the jury. And the reason is that firm buyback agreement is the inducement, and your investment completely secure is evidence that there is in fact a firm buyback agreement. So that's further evidence that firm buyback agreement means firm buyback agreement.
Counsel, now you've got me confused. Special issue number one inquires whether or not there be a firm buyback agreement, and you tell me that paragraph 8 is a firm buyback agreement.
No, I said, Your Honor, that paragraph 8 is what they are saying is a firm buyback agreement.
Well, what's unfirm about it?
Well, they don't say that it is a buyback agreement.
Well, it
agrees to repurchase.
Oh, excuse me.
does agree to repurchase not mean buyback?
That's what it means to me, and it's what it would mean to anybody else. But they're saying that it means that after you're in the deal, after you've already paid your money, and if you want to send stock back to them, that you can after the initial order, which excludes
the
first load, but it doesn't say that, and that's what's confusing, and that's why I wanted to impress on the court that type of phraseology in conjunction with the ad shows a present intent to deceive. And as the court said,
now, counsel, let me see if I got this straight. You're saying that paragraph 8 does not agree to buy back the first load.
I'm saying that that's their position.
That's their position. And it was your client's thought that the ad coupled with paragraph 8 would entitle him to get paid for the first load.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And they said, no, that's not what we meant at all.
We'll pay you
for the second load, but the first load, the $24,000, we're not going to pay you for.
That's correct, Your Honor.
It seems to me that this, like so many of our lawyer quarrels, is a play on words. Let me take a stab at it. The contention by NADW is that there, number one, would be a firm buyback agreement. Number two, they made a contract to buy back, and therefore they complied. Your contention is, there was, number one, an agreement that there would be a firm buyback. Number two, they did not buy it back. So it's this second step. You say they breached it when they did not buy it back. NADW says we complied when we made a contract to buy it back.
It's what that was going to be bought back.
That's correct, Your Honor. When NADW signed the contract and Dowling signed the contract, and then Dowling became disillusioned and said, give me my money back, the deal's on, then NADW's response was, and the evidence is replete with what they thought in the record. No, if he thought that firm buyback agreement meant that he got his money back, then that's wrong. We don't mean that. In other words, your investment is not completely secure. And we just put that in the ad to get you interested. It doesn't really mean that. And then they put in what appears to be a firm buyback agreement. What appears to be, and that's in the form of paragraph 8. And then hide behind it.
And then the actual offer, written offer to buyback, included everything except the cost of reselling the territory. Is that right? As I understand it.
That was their offer, yes, Your Honor. But in view
of... It was an offer to buy back everything they sold him, except for the cost of whatever it took to...
The cost and the commissions to the sellers and so on. It could be a fairly expensive proposition. And Mr. Dowling chose to take his grievance to the court. And in with respect to...
But the contract itself did not say, paragraph 8 does not say that they will buy back the $23,000 or $24,000 worth of materials. It says they will buy back materials after the first load.
Well, one other question.
If you wish to interpret it that way, but as I stated before, it's subject to a couple of interpretations. And I think that it should be construed and constructed against NADW because they made the contract and they're the ones. You, excuse me, Your Honor, I apologize.
This is on our time since the red light is on. If the Court of Civil Appeals were right and the trial court was right in finding that this issue number one was a promise, what do you contend is the jury finding that would bridge that gap of showing a present intent not to perform that promise in the future?
Okay, Your Honor, in the brief I cited Stone versus Lawyers Title Insurance Company, and the court of the Supreme Court of Texas said that the utterance of a known false statement made with the intent to induce action, in our opinion, is equivalent to an intent to deceive. So the utterance of that, of a known falsehood, is equivalent to an intent.
In issue number 6 said the representation was false. Bridges that gap for you?
That it was false, but if you go on, all of these have to be read in light of what they do, Your Honor. Special issue number 11. Says causing possible purchasers to act in reliance on it. 16 says did Dowling rely on it? Says yes, he did. Special issue number 21 was a representation in the newspaper ad to Don T. Dowling that there would be a firm buyback agreement made with knowledge that it was false. It was. All of the elements of common law fraud have been met, Your Honor, as articulated by not only this court, but federal courts construing our statute, as in Clark versus Cooley, which was quoted.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Counsel for respondent asked leave to file a supplemental brief, short brief. Permission will be granted. We noticed during the closing argument that such counsel had some other disagreement with what was being said, and I ask you to keep receipt. If you want to include that in your post-submission argument, that would be fine. I might add that I guess Dean Dallas, you're proud of Dick Dixon's and Judge Claude Williams' opinions. There are a number of opinions of this court which you might want to cite to us if you haven't already.
May I ask you one question, sir, that I think might clear up my reply in writing to the court?
I think I would prefer that you simply file your brief. And within a week, and counsel respondent, petitioner will have a week in which to reply.
Thank you.
May have whatever you want.
Thank you.
Case is submitted on written briefs and oral arguments for both parties. This concludes the oral submissions for the day, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
The audience, please rise. Oh yes, oh yes, oh yes. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.
Now, does that need to be spelled out?
Yes, sir.
You didn't know how much child support you have not paid?
Yes, sir.
You did not?
Yes, sir, I did not.
Well, I'm failing to get what you're arguing now.
The argument is that the court, in order to enforce its judgment, has to specifically find what the arrearage is and then order that that arrearage be paid. This can be found, I believe, in the Jenkins case, which is the brand new case that was passed down by the Dallas Court of Civil Appeals, which was based upon the pardon case, which I do not have, did not brief in this argument. And I don't have a copy or a site on that particular case with me today. The pardon case, as I remember, was a case in 1966, which says, was a Supreme Court case which said that this case, that the court, in order to enforce its judgment, must find a specific amount of the arrearage and then order that that arrearage be paid.
Now that would be true in the case of a coercive order in which the judge would say, I'm going to put you in jail until you pay delinquent child support in an amount of so-and-so.
Yes, sir.
Now, the orders that the judge rendered, was there a written order for contempt in this case, finding you in contempt?
No, sir.
The judge never did reduce to judgment after the hearing the fact that you were found in contempt of court.
There has been a judgment entered as of February the 6th after this court took jurisdiction of this matter. And that judgment, which I did not, and it's not briefed, but the pardon case, and I believe that if that judgment was submitted, the pardon case would also show that that case, that the amount of the arrearage, there is no finding as to the amount of the arrearage. There's a finding as to the months that were not paid. And the months that were not paid, if they're added up, does not equal to the amount of the arrearage that the judge orders to pay, and therefore it would be void because it does not specifically find what the arrearage would be.
Now, you were committed to jail in November?
Yes, sir, November the 16th.
And it's your statement that there was not a judgment on the contempt hearing that was reduced to writing until February
the 6th. The trial court failed to specifically spell out what the relator must do in order to gain his relief. It's point eight. In the case of Barr, the court has entered a punitive order of 1 day, confinement for contempt, and a coercive order for the relator to purge himself of said contempt. If the order is coercive, it must spell out what the relator must do to gain his release. That can be found in Ex Parte Hart, 520 Southwest 2nd, 952. In this case, even if the punitive order is good, the coercive order of the 219th under the Hart case would not be adequate in that it fails to specifically set out what must be done to gain release. The only thing that the commitment order says is that the conditions have been met and all payments made as set out in the attached exact copy of the judgment herein, and no judgment will enter until February the 6th, 1980, after this court took jurisdiction. Ex parte Spencer says that this court has jurisdiction of the matter, and they, once this court accepts jurisdiction or takes jurisdiction, that the court cannot go back, the original trial court cannot go back and enter an order found in Southwest 2nd 508 at 698 page 700, says, once the writ of habeas corpus was granted by this court, and this court was the Court of Civil Appeals in Texarkana, and delivered to the restraining officer, the applicant was no longer held under the original commitment, but under the direction and authority of that court, or the judge issuing the writ. Therefore, no valid order could be entered in the matter by the court making the original commitment, since this court had obtained jurisdiction of the prisoner by proceedings of habeas corpus. The court went on to say that the court which committed the relator to prison for contempt by verbal order could not, after her release on bail in the habeas corpus proceeding and pending such proceedings in that court, require the relator to purge himself of the contempt by a subsequently entered written order or judgment. And it's my contention that the February 6th order, which was entered after this court granted jurisdiction of this matter, has no effect on the proceedings that are before this court today. I thank the judges for their time, and I will save some arguments for rebuttal.
Your argument and respondent?
May it please the court, Mr. Michael Sibbles will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court, I do represent the respondent, and
who is the respondent?
Deborah Barnett, Deborah Diane Barnett.
Who represents the judge?
Pardon?
Is the judge also a party? Or?
Frankly, I don't know as far as...
Okay, I want to know who you represent.
I represent
the wife.
The wife, yes.
Okay.
I do think that there are three basic questions to be answered. One, whether the Collin County Court had jurisdiction to hold the relator in contempt for alleged violations and for found violations of the order of another court.
The first question will be, where is the contempt order? Beyond that, I don't know where you are.
There is, I disagree with the relator's contention that there is no contempt order. I say that it is contained in the written commitment order, a copy of which was attached to the relator's application for writ of habeas corpus. And it is, it's dated November 16th. It is in writing. I can refer you to the page on the transcript in which it's contained.
Is this the only document upon which you have to rely for the order after the contempt?
No, sir, it's not. It is the only one that was done immediately after the contempt and prior to the incarceration. I do rely on the February 10th, 1980 additional judgment of contempt.
The reason I asked that question, I've been looking at this commitment order dated November 16th, and it says, it refers to, quote, exact copy of the judgment of the court herein. And says the contempt officer shall be released from custody when all the conditions have been met and all payments made as set out in the attached exact copy of the judgment of the court herein. And you say that there is no exact copy.
Yes, sir, I say there is no exact copy except to the extent that it is contained on the face of this document itself. So, in the literal sense of it being another document being attached, no, there is not. In the sense that what he has done is combined a commitment order with a judgment of contempt and said, in effect, I find $5,250 in arrearage, $200 attorney's fees, $75 court costs, and I order that punishment is assessed at commitment in the Collin County Jail for 24 hours, confinement to continue until John Barnett purges himself of the above arrearage.
Does the court address its orders to the sheriff?
Normally, it certainly does not.
This does, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. At the same time, I don't think that that's fatal, Your Honor. And certainly, I think that this leaves a lot to be desired. And I think that the question is whether its contents sufficiently do two things. One, does it fairly apprise the relator of why, and considering the record, does it fairly apprise the relator of why he's being held in custody? And number two, does it tell him fairly what he has to do in order to gain release? And if those tests are accurate, I contend that this commitment order is sufficient to pass those tests. And I know of no case law, statutory law, or any other reason or any other criteria on which a commitment order or a contempt judgment should be based. Does the record support the finding that he's been found to be in contempt? And then does it fairly tell him what he has to do in order to gain his freedom?
Counsel, let me ask you this. Is this commitment order entered by the clerk in the minutes of the court to reflect what the judge has done on this proceeding?
Customarily, I do not know. I do know that it was entered in the minutes of this proceeding. In other words, this was entered as a judgment.
This commitment order appears in the minutes of Collin County?
I don't know the mechanics of it. As I understood it, they...
I'm not talking about docket entry. I'm talking about the records are permanently kept in the minutes of the clerk. And if the judge, as Justice Spears suggested, I'm very concerned this is addressed to the sheriff, but I don't know whether this is a judgment or not.
And I don't have personal knowledge of whether this actually appears in the minutes, but I would certainly think that it does.
Well, put another way, does the law require two instruments? Does the law require a judgment and an order of commitment, or simply a finding of contempt accompanied by an order of commitment? I know you have to have an order of commitment. Now, what's the state of the law with regard to whether this thing says there's another judgment or not, whether there has to be another written judgment?
I think there must be another written judgment, but I do not think that it has to be on a separate piece of paper. I think it can be incorporated, as was done here, on the same page, if you will, as the commitment order. I don't think that is the preferred practice by any means, but I don't think it's fatal for it to appear on the same page. Secondly, there is the order of February 10th, and I think that the cases that the relator cited in support of the idea of a judgment being entered at a later time talk about you can't have a written or a verbal commitment order and then reduce that commitment order to writing at a later time. That was the Spencer case, which relator cited as holding that once the writ of habeas corpus attached, that the trial court could not later come back and enter a written order. That case referred to the fact that there was no written commitment order. So I do not think that that
it's fatal. How would you distinguish this, where this was after he was placed in custody, the judgment was signed 2 or 3 months later? How do you distinguish that rule?
I distinguish it on the basis of a written, no written orders whatsoever, which was a Spencer case, versus a written commitment order in this, which is what we have in this case, and a judgment of contempt filed later. And I say that we don't even have to rely on that later judgment, but it's simply in better form. And that, again, going back to the test that I think the requirements are, does it find a violation of a previous order, and does it fairly apprise the defendant or relator as to what he must do in order to gain his freedom? And I say that this commitment order does that, and therefore suffices as with all the requirements of both a judgment of contempt and a written commitment order. And I don't know of any other requirements that are made or that should be made. In other words, to me it seems that is the things that are important to due process. And then, of course, the record must support the findings that the court has made as to whether the relator is in contempt or not. Certainly, a writ should issue, and I think properly would issue if the court found a person to be in contempt and the record didn't support that finding. Here, I think a fair reading of this commitment order would be a finding of a $5,250 arrearage and an order that punishment is assessed at commitment in the Collin County Jail for 24 hours, confinement to continue until John Barnett purges himself of the above arrearage.
Counsel, I think you would agree that a judgment of contempt in the form of a judgment, which contains a paragraph at the bottom ordering the sheriff to take the respondent into custody and confine him until he has purged himself by doing certain things, would be efficacious, would it not?
Absolutely.
And a copy of that judgment delivered to the sheriff would cause him to take that respondent into custody.
Yes, sir.
We have here the opposite, do we not? We have a commitment order that attempts to refer to the judgment rather than a judgment that attempts to incorporate a commitment order.
We did.
And the square question before us is, does it require a judgment of contempt before you can commit someone, no matter what the form of the order?
And
would you address yourself to that question?
I said yes, it does require a judgment of contempt. I can see.
Do you think you can enter it later, a couple of months later?
I think that he can't unless, well, no, I think he can't, but I think that's not what happened here. I think that what happened here is that there is a judgment of contempt. It's in very poor form. It is contained in the left-hand corner of the commitment order where it says a $5,250 arrearage.
We have a copy of that for us.
And so that is what I must rely on to meet the requirements of a judgment of contempt. Now, I do not feel uncomfortable with the position that having a written commitment order, that sometime later the judge may reduce the judgment of contempt to writing. So I guess I will back off of the statement that I made a minute ago. So I do not find it objectionable to later enter a written judgment of contempt if the previous commitment order or judgment of contempt has the two criteria that I think are necessary.
What case is it that says you have to have a judgment of contempt in addition to an order of commitment? If, for example, one of you gentlemen should have a book in your hand and threaten to throw it at me, and I say, don't you throw that book at me, and you throw the book at me and hit me in the head, can I not say, I find you in contempt, bang, and issue a commitment order?
I certainly think you can, yes, sir.
All right. Now, suppose I'm a district judge and I have ordered A to pay money, and this is all into the record, and he declines to pay, and I issue a show cause order, and I say, Mr. A, have you paid the money? No. Are you able to pay? Yes. Do you refuse to pay? Yes. I cannot then just issue a commitment order to the sheriff saying I find this gentleman in contempt?
Again, I would not feel, I think that you could. I do think that there is a requirement and a valid requirement that he be notified as to what.
Oh yeah, he's notified, he's standing right there. And here's a copy of my judgment saying you pay $200 a month or a week and you refuse to pay. You understand? Yes. You're able to pay? Yes. You just refuse to pay? Yes. Bang, Mr. Sheriff, here's issue order of commitment. I find you in contempt. Now, why do we have to sit down and write out a judgment? There may be some such rule. I'm just not familiar with it.
Counsel, this court wrote a decision involving a chicken plant up at Waco about 3 or 4 years ago, and in one of the holdings in that court, holding that there was not a valid commitment on contempt, one of the holdings was that on an indirect contempt, that is something that is done outside of the presence of the court, that could not be converted into a direct contempt by having the man appear and say, now do you disobey? And I think this court has crossed that bridge. Are you familiar with that case?
I am, Your Honor.
I think that question is addressed to me, and I remember it.
No.
I appreciate it.
But it was really my thought that we had decided that, and I can't recall the case.
And I don't remember the style. I think the rationale behind that, again, goes back to the two requirements that seem from a reading of all the cases to be important.
My memory is free will blood.
And I don't want to continue to bore the court with it, but it seems to me that the two important criteria are, does it fairly apprise him of why, in writing, well, why the constructive contempt, what the constructive contempt is. This does that. Does it tell him fairly what he has to do in order to be released? This does that in writing.
Can the judge do that with a letter? Write the respondent a letter? Got to use that?
I think it could be in the form of a letter if it were treated as a judgment, filed in the minutes, and so forth. In other words, I don't think there is any particular format that a judgment, any judgment, must take.
But it must be a judgment? Do you concede that?
I concede that, yes. And
don't tell anybody who can do it in the form of a letter, please.
I won't. I think that with a written commitment order, as long as those criteria are met, that it's a valid commitment order, valid judgment of contempt.
conceding that if it were correct, that a judgment could take any form, like a check can be written on the back of the cow, as the book says. What tells us that this document was intended by the court to be a judgment? That troubles me a little bit. I certainly don't feel that judgment's got to be on 8.5 by 11 or they're void. But this document says something about an attached judgment, which would make one think that maybe it wasn't intended to be a judgment, and that it was talking about another document which was a judgment.
I suppose the best evidence of its intent would be whether or not it was entered in the minutes there in Collin County as a judgment. And while that's not part of the transcript or directly before the court now, I would respectfully ask leave of court to bring that forward to let that be known whether it was entered as a judgment or not, since it is conceitedly ambiguous on its face to that extent.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand what you were requesting permission to do.
By supplemental transcript or other proper procedural method to bring in this record before this court a copy of the minutes of the judgment of the hearing that the court has